But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shodell, and I'm broadcasting to all you foodies out there. And sitting here with me is co-host and producer Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom.
What's happening?
I'm still shaking.
Yeah.
So I learned the meaning of the Italian word agita.
Ah, what happened?
So I learned the lesson that it's very fulfilling but very stressful to be the person involved with arranging for the prom bus for 40-something kids in Merrick.
Oh, good luck. Yeah.
So until the bus arrived, I was a mess.
So you had your own personal prom night, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nice. It was great. You know, the bus driver calls me and he says, I'm staged a block away. I'll be right there. 20 minutes later, I thought they were playing a game with me. You know, it still wasn't there.
Yeah, yeah.
And then until it actually pulled up, oh, my goodness.
There's nothing like responsibility, you know. I've done events and things, you know, run golf tournaments and charity affairs and all of that. And you just can't depend on anybody. It's like nobody else seems to have the urgency, you know, that you have.
So I'm going to throw a lot of ethnic slurs around. So in my day, I've worn a lot of different hats. So one of the things I used to do was book limo travel for companies. And I worked for somebody.
Right.
So somehow, I was the one that got the responsibility for this prom. And it was 40-something kids. And one of the children on the bus was the daughter of the guy that I worked for. And he gave me what in Jewish they say, a kinahara.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the, you know, a death wish.
No.
and he goes, when he passes me, he goes, I'm glad you're the one with the responsibility tonight.
Yeah, sure. You know, speaking of proms, I just had to pull it. I didn't go to my senior prom because I didn't really care. I wasn't a big high school rah-rah-rah guy. But I did go to my friend's prom the year before I graduated. I was a junior in high school. And he was a senior at Tresper Clark High School in Westbury. So essentially what happened was he invited me and my girlfriend at the time. I went as his girlfriend's date, and my girlfriend went as his. So we all went. And I don't remember where it was, but you know who played there? You know who was the band?
I can only imagine.
The James Gang. Joe Walsh. Joe Walsh was actually, in his, the nascent part of his career there, it was just starting out. I think Funk 49 had just come out or whatever, And yeah, they had James Gang playing that. It was just reminiscent. I said, gee, I wish I had some pictures of that,
Well, was that at the Carl Place School District?
No, it was Tresper Clark, which is Westbury, the other side of Westbury.
Well, there must be somebody that has the joke of everything is probably nobody – they weren't that big, so nobody really cared.
No.
But it would be priceless to have a picture of the band and Joe in it.
Yeah, I mean, I was probably – being a guitar player, I was probably the only one who knew that, who he was or whatever. And it was just such a thrill to see him. I remember being, oh, my God, Joe – Joe Walsh, wow, this is really cool,
So I have to get into this a little bit. You talk about the James Gang. You talk about Joe Walsh. You talk about the Eagles.
Mm-hmm.
The Eagles are actually going on tour. They're playing this summer.
They probably need the money.
What? That's always a big discussion because, you talk to these veteran musicians and rock stars or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And, even especially in today's world with the pandemic, is it worth their while to go out there and get sick? Well, hopefully everything's contained, so we say, it's protected, but are meet and greets a thing of the past? And again, how much money do you need? But then you start really analyzing it, and if somebody in their prime has a jet and 14 houses or whatever, either you have to decrease the inventory of real estate or you got to keep making that money.
Well, yesterday's luxuries are today's necessities,
Right, right. So let's talk a little music real quick. So Joe Walsh had his success, I guess, in the 70s with the James Gang and the song that you just said.
Funk 49,
and there was a Casey at Bat or whatever.
That was more his solo career, I think.
Oh, okay. But at any rate, so then somehow Joe... Well, another interesting point, I'm rambling on here, but Joe Walsh's brother-in-law is Ringo Starr.
I know.
That's incredible. But so Joe Walsh had his own career. The Eagles had their own thing. I guess they were all out in California with their friends, and at one point Joe Walsh becomes a member of the Eagles.
Yes. In my opinion, saved the band.
That's what I wanted to get into. Some people say, oh, Joe Walsh has no place in the band or whatever, and others welcomed him to the band like you did, and not as just like a temporary guest playing with them or whatever, but he's a, you know, 40 years later, you know.
Well, he's a bitchin' guitar player. I mean, and you know, the Eagles, in my humble opinion, needed that. They were more like a country kind of band, you know. I mean, they were a backing band for
it was all
Bob
part
Dylan
of, like, the Southern California environment. I think Linda Ronstadt, Jackson Brown.
Yeah, it was all that
maybe
soft.
Maybe even Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young was part of that
stuff.
Yeah,
folk rocky kind of stuff, but more folky, you know. When Joe Walsh came in, he gave a rock edge to the band.
Oh, and he had a persona. He had a rock persona.
He's out of his mind is what he is. I mean, thank God he quit drinking. You know, I mean, there's another guy that, you know, did the world a favor. But, you know, he's a very talented guy, and I think that they needed that. But, you know, who am I? I mean, you know, I'm not going to tell the Eagles how to behave, but, you know, they're doing fine without my help, last I heard.
There you go.
But I think he added a dynamic that was sorely needed in that band. He added some crunch to it, you know.
So I got to tell you that this experience with the prom I have so much material to talk about it. It's really crazy. So afterwards, they have a pre-prom party, and all the kids come and all the parents are there. They take pictures or whatever. And again, everybody's still trying to navigate
through. And what food is served there?
Really no food, because the kids aren't eating really. I was shocked that the boys were, like, busy smoking cigars. Now, me, I would have been dizzy and forget about it. That would have been the end of it.
Yeah.
But the kids get on the bus. They go on their way. And some of the parents say, now we need a drink.
Yeah, of course.
And the host of the party brought out some cognac and some brandy.
Yeah.
And he was talking about his liquor collection. It was just very interesting. But what really became interesting was the two couples that were there, and I was talking to the husbands, were both immigrants from Russia or the Ukraine or whatever.
Right.
And the story that they told of their coming to America is mind-boggling. The nuances of being able to officially leave the country and have to spend time in different European countries, 3 months, 6 months at different places to move on to the next place to get to the ability to come over. And one of the husbands was probably in his mid-40s.
Right.
So he was a little younger than the other gentleman, who was probably in his 50s. But the one that was in his 50s said he actually landed in Brooklyn. You know, somehow they flew into Kennedy. They got transported and dropped off. And this is all legitimate stuff.
Yeah.
But with $20 in his pocket.
Wow.
And now he seems to be a very successful business person. He has a daughter that's going to Northeastern, just took a job with Johnson & Johnson relative to their drug empire.
Yeah.
And then the other gentleman, who, again, was a little younger, was telling, you know, a similar story. And again, when you hear people talk about, you know, I got things tough.
Please, you know, when I hear people knocking this country, you know, it gets me crazy, because where else, you know, and just to even, you know, inject food into this, because that's what we're supposed to be doing, you know, the evidence is all around you. You go into a supermarket and have 40 different types of potatoes, you know, 19 different types of lettuces, you know, 30 different types of tomatoes, you know, the abundance here. And what we have is taken for granted on such a grand scale that it's frightening, you know. You have all these people out there protesting what a terrible place this is. Then why are you bringing them in? You know what I mean? You have half of your government saying this place is terrible, it's racist, this, that, and the other thing, and yet they're bringing people in.
These two families, why would you bring people into this terrible place? So impressed.
It's nuts.
You know, when they talk about, you know, their work ethic, their sense of family, and all this. And it was, to me, it was incredible. It really, really was. So
my grandfather is one of those. You know, he came from England and Liverpool, actually, area, Wigan, which is just outside. And same thing, he landed in, you know, in Canada and emigrated through Detroit. And same thing, he tells me a story about he came with a dollar in his pocket. I'm sure it was more than that. I'm sure it's a bit of an exaggeration, but not really. You know, I mean, they were broke, you know, and they got here. That's why they came. I mean, mm-hmm. he was a coal miner, you know. Not a lot of work in coal mining these days, you know. But anyway, we should probably get to food, right? Because we're
going to
get yelled at for the politics.
We will. But this is it. Part of where I was going is that the gentleman that was the host for this parents' part of the night, he served a cognac and a brandy. And I learned that cognac, much like champagne and sparkling wine, cognac is a region,
yeah.
Which was pretty cool to learn. But he was also talking about Portuguese wine.
Yeah.
And he was saying that it's a very interesting country,
yeah.
And quite an interesting array of grapes that come from there.
Yeah, they do. They do real nice wines in Portugal. You know, Alvarinhos, which
that's
in
what
Spain
I had.
They call it Albarino with a B, and Alvarinho, AHLV in Portuguese. And they do a lot of good red wine there.
That's exactly what I had in Alvarino.
Yeah,
a Quevedo family, and it was Avarinho.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the you know, Portugal's right there with Spain, so it's the same, you know, latitude, longitude thing, you know, so the climate's very, very similar. You know, they have a maritime climate along the coast there. And, yeah, they grow a lot of grapes in Portugal. And actually, Portuguese wines are really the bargain of the world at the moment. You know, you can find them fairly inexpensive. You'll find them fairly inexpensive when you go to buy them, and the quality level is a lot of them are just off the charts.
And it just clicks in my mind. It's just so funny that the country of Portugal we're talking about. But yesterday, I also had in the morning, I had a meeting with some people, and they were talking about Portuguese food. And apparently, there's a big Portuguese community in Mineola.
Yeah, Mineola is famous for that. There's a bunch of good Portuguese
restaurants.
So there's
like a Rodizio.
Rodizio's there, yeah.
And then we were talking that I guess the family that owns that restaurant, I believe it's the son, opened something in Belmore.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And those are really cool restaurants. I guess it's not all of Portuguese restaurants do the same, but it's one of those restaurants where they come around and serve you all these different meats, I mean, on skewers, and it just keeps coming.
Churrascaria, they call them.
Yes, yeah, that's yeah. exactly it.
Yeah.
And then between, you know, chicken and fish and the meats, the sausage.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. I mean, they roast a lot of those things on skewers and rotisseries, you know, and they'll bring the skewer to the table, and they usually give you a block of wood, and one side's green, one side's red. So as long as the green's up, they keep bringing stuff to you. And when when you've reached the Henry VIII moment, you know, where you can't eat another thing, you turn it over and it's red, and then they know to stop. And they're fun. You know, there's a place in the city that I went a couple of times called Churrascaria Platforma. I don't know if it's still there. It was on the west side somewhere. I think in the 50s or the 60s or something like that. But really good. They're fun experience. I guess, you know, it's kind of a fun place to go with a group. They have one over in right across from Roosevelt Field now.
Oh, yes.
Fugu de Chao or
yes.
Fugu de Chao
yes,
or something
I heard
like
about
that.
That.
I haven't been there, but yeah, I understand it's the same kind of concept, you know. And they usually have a salad bar, you know, you go up and make your own salad, then you sit down and they start bringing food to you until you can't, you know, can't tolerate it anymore, you know.
Yeah, my son went to the Fugu with a bunch of his friends, actually during the pandemic. And I think they had to, like, you know, as everybody, remodel what their – how they were serving,
sure,
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But somehow they still got it done. But yeah, no, it was again, it was interesting that you know, Portuguese cuisine came up multiple times. And then the night before, I was at a fundraiser for law enforcement, and there were some people talking about, you know, Platt Deutsch. I don't know if you're familiar with that restaurant.
Yeah, yeah, German place.
Yeah, and I guess we've talked about that a little bit in the past couple of weeks, but that's some real good, wholesome food.
Oh, that's stick-to-your-rib stuff. That's winter food for me, man. You know, and it's a cuisine that you don't see much around anymore, you know. There used to be, I think in Ridgewood, there was a big German community in Queens. And there used to be a bunch of German restaurants there that I remember. But I don't know of too many. Like the one I went to in Lantern in Farming in Lindenhurst, I told you about a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, you had a family gathering.
Yeah, yeah. And it was fun. It was fun to see. It was fun to go. It's not a place that I would go to all the time. It's just not my favorite, you know, cuisine kind of thing. But it's nice to see that some people are preserving it, you know. It's I think it's valuable, you know, and I think there's a market for it, you know. I mean, they were pretty busy the night I was there, so.
Gotcha.
You know, good for them.
So I just need to we always ask our listeners to write in with memories, this, that, and the other, and they do that by contacting us at fire@whli.com. fire@whli.com. And we got an email last week. We were talking about memories of growing up and how your parents took you from chicken fingers and fries to something more substantial.
Porterhouses
and somebody wrote in, and they wrote in about Stouffer's.
Stouffer's, yeah.
Which was a restaurant in Garden City.
Sure, yeah, I remember that.
And one of the questions he asked the listener, and I apologize, I don't have the email in front of me, so I don't have your name in front of me. But he asked the question if the Stouffer Food Company, the frozen foods and stuff that you see in the supermarket, is related to that restaurant.
I believe
that
they were
was
the same people.
Oh, really?
So yeah, Stouffer's was a chain.
Oh.
So I'm pretty sure it was owned by Stouffer's. Otherwise, there would have been lawsuits flying all over the place, you know.
So it was funny. So our listener said that, you know, again, usually he had, you know, I guess kid food along the way.
Yeah.
Every so often, the family would go into Gardens. He, I think, grew up in Mineola.
Okay.
So they'd venture into Garden
the
City,
district.
Where
yeah.
Stouffer's was. And but he said he must have been a real pig because he said his father would let him get a steak for dinner and a steak for dessert.
Nice. Yeah, that's called, what do you call it, coming of age. You know what I mean? My father wouldn't give me a steak for a week, never mind two in the same day. But yeah, it was another place over there on Franklin Avenue, and the name will come to me in a minute. But they used to have a cart with a prime rib on it, you know, and they would wheel the cart to your table and cut the prime rib right in front of you.
I did that in Vegas, I think, or Chicago, Lowry's.
Lowry's, yeah, yeah.
That was pretty cool. But yeah, you could get like an end cut or there were different even cuts of, I guess, prime rib.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun concept. I mean, some of those things, you know, to bring back. I've often fantasized about, you know, bringing back tableside cooking, you know, where you do crepe Suzette and bananas flambé and, you know, you're boning ducks and stuff like that. It requires some talent in the dining room to do that. You know, you have to have waiters who know how to do it. But, you know, we're so overregulated now. It's like, you know, now the fire department doesn't want you doing anything like that in the room. I mean, no restaurant burns down over crepe Suzette.
But it brings back memories. When I was newly married and had a young daughter, we would take her to dinner. And I guess she resembled Shirley Temple at one point.
Uh-huh.
So it's like a flashback into the past. But we went to the North Shore Steakhouse. And
Edmund Showcase.
Edmund Showcase.
That
you
was the
it.
Restaurant in Garden City.
You got it.
Sorry about that.
It's all good.
Yeah.
So we would go to North Shore Steakhouse, which was a nice restaurant in the Great Neck area. And it was just like you said, table side serving. But the best was to get the freshly made Caesar salad. You know, and they would bring stalks of lettuce,
yeah.
and they would break that up, and then they would stir in the egg and the mustard and the anchovy. And that was just really cool. But again, there I was, newly married. I had this cute little kid that looked like Shirley Temple. Again, it was like the Donna Reed show.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, I made thousands of those Caesar salads, you know. I used to work for a guy years ago. His name was Hugo Bua, B-U-A, and Hugo was a character and a half. It would take 10 shows to describe what a nut Hugo was. But he was such a showman when he made the Caesar salad, and he plated it for you. You know, there was nothing left. He would hold the bowl over his head to show you that the dressing viscosity was so perfect, there was nothing left in there, and it coated the thing, and it wouldn't drip down over his ears. He was some character, but a fabulous maitre d'. I never saw anyone better. He had it. He was suave, good looking. You know, he had an Italian accent. He was just he was the perfect prototype. If you had to cast a movie, you know, with a maitre d' in it, he was the guy. You know, he was perfect at it, and. He had restaurants on Long Island for a long time, La Strada out in Smithtown, and he had Hugo's Continental. I think that was in Hop Hog, you know. And last I heard, I think he's down in Florida now. I think he finally retired and went down and, you know, to eat dinner at 4:30 in the afternoon now. He's doing the Florida trip, you know. But that era was kind of like the golden age of, I think, restaurants to some degree. You know, I think the food's better now. It's more diverse. It's more interesting. But there was something about that dressing up, you know, going to one of those restaurants like the Lincoln Inn. You remember in Rockville
sure.
Center, right?
Now it's Frank's Steakhouse.
Yeah. They used to do all that tableside cooking. And I just found that to be, I don't know, kind of movie star elegant. You know, there was things going on there. You know, men used to wear suits or jackets and women would get dressed up. And
well, I remember my grandfather used to tell me that he grew up in Chicago. And, I mean, on Saturday nights, the thing to do was to go to a, I guess, like a hotel. They would have a gala.
Yeah, the,
you know,
the
and they'd be
band.
In and they'd be in tuxedos. And,
yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm the antichrist when it comes to dressing up. I mean, you know, you've seen how I look. I have a bigger T-shirt collection than most actors and actresses.
Yes, and today you're wearing your Raynor's chicken T-shirt.
That's right. I'm representing.
Yeah, Raynor's was a legendary restaurant on Long Island, and it's become a pop-up every so often through a guy named Butch Amali and mm-hmm. Dover Caterers. He's the proprietor of like the catering hall in
Coral
House.
Yeah,
yes, Coral yes, House. Yes, and
yeah.
Then Malibu went down, and so but you actually got that shirt here at one
I
of
did.
Our recording sessions.
Yes, yeah. Mom and Dad went to Raynor's, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt. You know? But you know, I every once in a while, I see on the internet there's this kind of like trip down memory lane with restaurants that were legendary on Long Island aren't there anymore. Do you ever see one of those things?
Yeah,
it's a retrospective of you know. Some of the things, and you know, I'm old enough to remember almost all of them, you know, which is a little scary, you know. But, I just remember that whole strip on Old Country Road where I kind of grew up in Westbury, a Car Place area. You know, they had the Sirloin Steak Pub where I used to work, and down the block was Mimo's, which was an Italian restaurant. That's now it's a, I don't know, a takeout, what do they call it, a Taco Bell or whatever. And then you go down a little further, it was Cherry Stone Inn, you know, it was like a seafood place down there. They had Pepe's where we all used to go after work for drinks and pizza when we were underage. And then on the corner where that little Italian restaurant is now
Bocce?
Yeah, where Bocce is was a place called Felice's, oh. Which was a huge restaurant, big Italian restaurant. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I go back and in time, and I remember the Wagon Wheel and, you know, all these other places, John Peel Room.
The Wagon Wheel, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, that was right on the corner of Ellison Avenue and Old Country Road. But, yeah, it's you know, restaurants, they don't have the lifespan, you know. I was just talking to my friend Billy the other day, who Bill Holden is a friend of the show and owned West End Cafe and the Market Bistro in Jericho. And I was telling him that, you know, West End Cafe is a place that he kind of put on the map, but they've been open since like 83. You know, they're going on 30 years, you know, which is, you know, incredible for a restaurant. It's an incredible run. They're still busy, you know, which is a testament to quality of the place and the appeal. You know, they do a great job there. And, you know, I think I always said the restaurants age like dogs. You know, every 1 year is every seven, you know, kind of thing. It's equal to 7 years because it's such a difficult business and it's getting worse. As far as bottom line goes now, I mean, you know, everybody who's shopped have seen the prices of, you know, food, gas, everything's just soared upwards in the last couple months.
You had to mention
you know.
Gas.
I know, right? Do you have some?
I'm
worried about you. We have a cough button, you know.
I think a year ago we were probably paying about a dollar a gallon less than we are now.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's just... you know, I get people, you know, complaining about prices at the restaurants. Say, well, what do you want me to do? I mean, I'm not a candy striper. This isn't volunteer work.
Okay.
You know?
So now you opened the Pandora's box. So during the pandemic, I know there's been some
the
restaurants.
Pandemic box.
Yes. Yes. They've done surcharges.
Yeah.
But here's the one I want to ask you about. I mean, you're pretty level-headed and honest. To accept criticism as well as criticize others.
Sure.
This new thing about charging a surcharge for using a credit card.
Right.
What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's insane. Why would you advertise something like that? I think it's abject stupidity. It's almost like when they do surcharges for, for the help. Every once in a while, I'll see on a menu, we're charging 3% to give our employees health care or this, that, and the other thing. And I just think it's a vanity move. I think it's they want you to know how wonderful they are, the owner. Why don't you just, hide that in the price of admission, or the price of the steak and be done with it, I just think charity is supposed to be a little on the quieter side. So if you're going to do something nice like that, out of the goodness of your heart, do it. And if you want to advertise it, then I think there's another motive. I think it's, you're telling everybody what a wonderful human being you are. And you may be, but, I just think it's kind of tacky. I don't think that has any place, really, on a menu. We're not saving the world here. We're just, doing dinner and to, to have that out there seems kind of silly. I think, some menus have gotten kind of ridiculous over the years also. I think that, when you have those soliloquies on the front, Chef Peter Purity only uses, organic, vegetables grown in a completely neutral acid garden with rainfall twice a day and, fish from pristine waters. And, aren't we all doing that as a matter of course? I mean, it seems to me is we're more aware of everything that's going on now food-wise. But I don't know how you feel about it, but I just feel, Stu, that if like I was just saying, when somebody puts, we're charging a 3% surcharge to give our employees, a quality of life, health care, this, that, and the other thing, and if you don't want to pay it, don't pay it. But to me, that just screams vanity on the part of the owner. Like, I'm a wonderful person, and look at what I'm doing for my people, and you will be a wonderful person if you pay the 3%. And if you don't, you should probably feel guilty about it.
Well, again, there's the credit card one. But then, actually, I think it was Monday morning, I don't know if you ever watched the network Cheddar.
No.
It's Channel 1 on Cablevision, but it's interesting news, facts, and stuff. Like a quick news update type thing. But at any rate, they were talking about, I think it was Chipotle, was going to be doing some sort of surcharge. And it had to do with the raising of the hourly minimum wage.
Right.
And they said they were doing the increase so that they could pay their workers. And somebody said something stupid like, a happy burrito is a... makes for a good day. At any rate, they said, if it's really truly used to benefit the employees, why not?
But why don't you just hide it?
But is that real?
Hide it in the price. What are you sitting at? You're making political statements on a menu. It doesn't belong there. Just like political statements doesn't belong on this show here, we've been told. And they're right. This is a food, wine, and lifestyle show. We're not supposed to be talking about politics. And I get that. It creeps into conversations here and there because it's all around us. But, the bottom line is, why are you making political statements on you? I have a friend of mine who had a restaurant in a town in Suffolk County. And it doesn't matter where it is. And he would go on and on and on the internet about Trump, Hated him, this, that, and the other thing. He's dangerous. He's Hitler. All the, usual crap that, people spew, right? And I said to him, why would you want to alienate 50% of your clientele? Because half the country believes one way and the other half believes the other, right? So, okay, do you think you've changed any minds? Do you think you've gotten that percentage down to 75-25 in your favor because of all your ranting? Nobody really cares what you think. You're just making them mad. You know what I mean? I need all the customers I can get. You don't want the Republican customers? Send them to me. I'll take them. You know what I mean? I'll take the Democrats. I'll take the independents. I'll take them all, And he went out of business, And I don't think it's a coincidence, honestly. You can't, it doesn't belong there. Restaurants are places to go to enjoy yourself, not to be telling everybody what you think about this one or that one. Or, you know, I'm doing a service charge because I'm a wonderful person and I'm giving health care to my employees. Then shut up and give it to them, you know? Charity's supposed to be quiet. It's not supposed to be bandied about. There's a difference between charity and self-promotion. And I think that, you know, if you start to tell everybody how charitable you are, you cross that line into self-promotion. And I just think it's, I think it's a bad idea.
So here we sit, two radio hosts bantering about different things. What are we going to talk about today?
You know, I don't know. This is a show about nothing. I have nothing to say. Well, we'll end the show with Tom Streaky a bit early. No, we could talk about anything, you know, food related. And you know, it's a subject that's close to my heart. It's and I will tell you a cognac story. But what's great about food is that everybody needs it, or I don't know about needs it, but, you know, would like to have it three times a day, roughly, you know. And between the seasons and everything that's involved, there's really no end to the conversation. And it starts anew next year when every crops come in spring. And, you know, it's just, it's a fun, you know, for me, I found out early in my life what I wanted to do. I was one of the lucky ones. I still enjoy it. And that gift isn't lost on me. It was a gift from the cosmos that, you know, stuck me in the position I was in. And the conspiracy of events that led me to the career that I've had was just, you know, good fortune. The stars lined up that way or whatever. And, you know, I talked to friends who retired, you know, around my age or whatever, and they hated their job. They hated their boss. They hated the commute. They hated this. I've never once felt that way. I couldn't wait to get to work. I still can't wait to get to work some days, most days, you know. I mean, there are some days where, you know, like I have something coming up where I have to cater for, you know, 1,200 people. I'm not looking forward to that, honestly. You know, I'm looking forward to the check, you know, for sure. But it's, it, you know, that's one of those days. It's like going to war. That's not like going to work, you know.
Well, but that brings up something to me. I went to a fundraiser the other night at one of the local catering halls, and I just can't wrap my head around the fact that catering hall food is good. I don't know if it's the level of the event. Again, I know a charity event, they're not going for the most expensive things, but this was a middle of the road type of thing. I think there was chicken marsala, there was like a fish dish, there was a paella type thing.
Now, was all done by the caterer, or was it done by different restaurants?
No, it was but it was just like, everything was too salty or too this or too that. I'm a pretty easy-to-please guy, but I had a great night, great people, great, mm-hmm. you know, event. But when I just said the food sucked.
Well, there's different levels of caterers, just like there's different levels of restaurants, and not everybody's in it for the same motives, you know? I mean, some of us are in it for the art, and we, I think those of us that are, try a lot harder than people who are in it because it's a business. And I think the people who are in it because of business make a lot more money than people who are chasing the art, you know.
But like then, this is a new one. My cousin's having a Sweet 16. This is something, again, the pandemic put off for 12 months, 18 months, whatever
27.
It was. But, you know, I had to show my vaccination card. I got to do all this stuff. in preparatory for the evening.
Yeah.
So they asked me to choose my food for the evening.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get it done.
Am I going to be in the mood for next Friday?
It was prime rib. Yeah. It was a sole oreganata. It was for kids. There was the chicken fingers with fries.
Yeah.
And there was, again, maybe chicken marsala or something. And again, my mind just kept going back to this catering event then a couple of nights before. And I said, the fish is going to be dry. The chicken marsala is going to be too salty for me. Mm-hmm. Not getting chicken fingers. So I went with the prime rib. And something tells me I'm not going to be all that happy. But
you know, you make concessions for volume. And this is where art, it's the nexus of art and economics, right? So you're trying to do the right thing. But the more the volume goes up, the more you have to deal down the artistic thing for the sake of expediency and you know, and being able to feed all these people, this, that, and the other thing. So I have a catering business, right, that I do only off-premise events. I do them in the vineyards out east and, you know, different locations, whatever. And I can't tell you how many times people, and this isn't self-promotion, I'm just saying that the state of most catering places is mediocre stuff, and it doesn't matter because there's only one person that you have to please, and that's the bride's mother. But she's like the Lawrence Taylor of the operation. I mean, she's the one that if you don't pay attention to her, there's going to be a big problem, right?
That's
so
true.
Yeah. And if she's happy, you're getting paid. And if she's not, there's going to be an issue. So anyway, most caterers don't really, I don't say they don't care, but they're satisfied with a certain level of food because of the economics of hiring a very talented chef or whatever. It costs a lot of money. Buying prime instead of choice costs money, you know. And there's a business end to it. And I get it, you know, and good for them. I mean, it's fine. I on the other hand, don't care about making money so much, and I don't mean that in a flippant way. I just, it's not my primary concern. My primary concern is the product. And does it always work? No. Do I blow dinners? Yeah, of course. You know, have I had complaints? Yes, I've had complaints. Of course I've had complaints, you know. But that's not for lack of trying. And that's, you know, those of us who are in this for the sake of the art operate that way. It's quality and presentation and servicing the guest first. And then if we make some money after that, great. If we lose some money after that, we're in trouble. If we break even, I'm still okay. You know, this is why I'll never be really wealthy. I mean, I've had a million restaurants and I'm still driving around in a Ford. You know what I mean? It's not like I got a Ferrari or a private plane, you know? So it just, I think that's the difference between, you know, catered affairs. You know, we're getting more and more. I'm doing something in a couple of days where they want mini tacos served in carved out limes, you know, because Pinterest is really, you know, driven, you know, most caterers crazy because they have all these pictures, these wonderful events that, you know, are one-offs.
Well, that's very funny. I met a neighbor the other night, and just last night, and she's a great cook. I mean, this is a woman. You know, the husband can bring home fresh clams, and next thing you know, they're diced up in this linguine and white clam sauce.
Lovely.
Oh, she'd make a sandwich, just the plainest sandwich. You know, she knows how to do it. You know,
it's my dream date.
Just the right amount of mayonnaise, a fresh tomato. So I said to you, you know, you're still a good cook. She's divorced now or whatever, and the kids are older. She goes, yeah. She goes, I even got a blog now. On Instagram, I got of, you know, real serious foodies following me. You know, I post pictures of my food, And yes, food today is such a visual thing.
Oh, totally. Is it? My daughter just, you know, opened up some kind of account for me. She goes, you got to send me pictures. You don't have any kind of technology background or, you know, nothing about what's going on. I'm going to make this happened for you. And I'm like, all right, I have no idea. So I send her pictures of stuff I make. And, you know, what she does with them, I have no idea. I've never seen it. I don't care about it so much, whatever. But, I mean, everybody's got, you know, everybody's an expert in the restaurant business, you know. Food blogs all over the place. You know, I had a guy who was, I can't remember his handle, but he was a self-proclaimed food critic, you know. And he decided to take me to task for a meal that he had in one of my places, and he actually called me a ganef, which I think is Yiddish for thief, because of the prices were so expensive, and he didn't like the meal, and this was that, and that was the other thing, and who the hell do you think you are? And you know, I mean, really on me for a restaurant that I not only didn't own, I didn't even know where it was, you know. So he's doing a review on a restaurant and yelling at me over the internet. And I had nothing to do with it. And I wrote back to him. I said, you know, I very rarely answer these, but you're so off base and ridiculous that I felt compelled to tell you what a jerk you are. First of all, I've never had anything to do. I didn't consult on that restaurant. It's not mine. I don't know where it is. I've never stepped foot in it. He goes, what does that matter? if you're going to be a restaurant critic, you would think that would matter, you know. It's hilarious. And I told him, I said, why don't you come on? I'll tell you what, I'll invite you on my radio show and you can enlighten us with your restaurant chops. And, you know, why don't you come on and we'll talk about it? You know?
You're proud of your involvement with different restaurants, so much so that you even name them twice.
I do. Well, it's like guys need three. Guys have to be told things three times, right? That's why you have triple X. They don't get the first two X's, right? What's that X about? The second, I don't get that. Oh, I know what that is. You know what I mean? It's like, take out the garbage. Take out the garbage. Take out the garbage. Oh, yeah, I get it. Take out the garbage, you know? So anyway, if I you know, tell them twice, it's because I'm reminding them what it is.
So now, what's this cognac story?
Oh, God. Well, you know, I do this bit on Jim Douglas's show on 103 Max. Every Friday morning about bad customer, crazy customer stories or whatever, you know. It's kind of what I've been known for, I guess, to some degree. And I just write about them. I mean, everybody experiences these. I'm the only idiot writing about them, right? anyway, so I told a story about, I told two stories, but I did them chronologically backwards. So I'll chronologically frontwards for them.
So that's good. So I can fact check to know that it's chronologically in order.
Yes, if you... prone to do that. So anyway, when I was 18 years old, I was in culinary school and looking at the future of my career, and you know, I was excited about it, and you know, I'd worked in restaurants for 2 or 3 years before that, and now I'm really taking this professional, you know, turn at it, and I wanted to see what all this great cuisine was about. And at the time, it was the French restaurants in New York. It was Lutèce and Grand Huit and, you know, La Caravelle, all these places were the top-tier restaurants in Manhattan. So I used to save up money in my part-time jobs that I was working when I was going to school, and I would save up for like 2 months, you know, which amounted to about $60 or whatever the hell it was. And I would go into the city, and I would eat in these restaurants just so I could experience what these fabulous chefs were able to do, you know? I still do that, actually. But anyway, so I was going into Lutèce. I think it was Lutèce. It was Lutèce or Grand Wheel. I don't remember. But I dragged a friend of mine with me, so we took our girlfriends in, and we were going to, you know, all dressed up, and we were going to play adult and go to these restaurants. So, and he's like 4 years older than me, right? And had nothing to do with the restaurant business, but he was just a good sport, and he liked food, so in we went, right? And we had this French experience, and the French were a little condescending back then, you know? And it's funny because it was a language barrier, and that was really what they were kind of relying on. Like, when it became apparent that Galantine de Valais Champignon was chicken with mushrooms, you know, their whole guys went up in smoke, you know? So, anyway, they would beat you up a little bit. And this guy sees us coming in. There's a bunch of kids, you know, and he's like, kind of, you know, am I going to get a tip? And he wasn't really all that attentive until the end of the meal. So at the end of the meal comes, and I'm about to show him what a sophisticate I am, you know. And I said to him, do you have any Martel Cordon Bleu, which was the only cognac I'd ever had in my life. And it was fairly expensive at the time. It was probably $5 a glass or something, which was a lot of money back then, right? So he said, oui, monsieur, but perhaps I could suggest something just a little finer. I said, all right, I'll take finer. What do you got? He goes, we have Louis XIII, Remy Martin, 75-year-old cognac. Exquisite. Fine, give us four. Now, it's $25 a pour at the time. I have no idea, right? This is 1971. $25 a glass. A shot of vodka was 35 cents. You know what I mean? A beer was a nickel. You know, it was crazy, right? So I order four for the four of us. I just ordered $100 worth of cognac. I have no idea. I had like $80 in my pocket, right? And we haven't paid for dinner yet. So it turns out it's the finest cognac I had tasted at the time. I tasted two. You know what I mean? So anyway, give us another four. Now I'm up to $200, unbeknownst to me. The girls, thank God, passed on the last round, and Marty and I had one more because we're abusers, you know? So I have a $250 cognac bill about to arrive that I have no idea is coming, plus dinner, which is probably $100 for the four of us, whatever the hell it was. So I get this bill for $350, and I'm picking up the tab, right? I have like $80 on me, $100, whatever it was, you know? It was woefully inadequate. Anyway, I do this Jackie Gleason, humming. Are you kidding me? You know, $25. And I'm saying, that bastard, you know what I mean, did this to me. And so my friends look at me, what's up? So I show him the bill. He's looking at me. He's priceless. He just looks at the bill. He looks at me and he goes, is there anything else you'd like to try before we leave here today? I said, I'd like to try and see if you have a credit card because I don't have enough money. And thank God he had a master charge or whatever it was. We put it on the bill. It took me like 5 months to pay it off. I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe that guy. I mean, he must have seen me coming, you know. So anyway, fast forward to the story that I told Jim first, which I probably should have told him second. There is a God, and things balance out. You know, it's the nature of the universe, right? Everything yin and yang. And so the same guy, Marty and I, became my business partner. We were building this place in East Hampton, and there was no heat. We were out there in the winter, and we were too cheap to turn it on. We didn't have enough money, right? So we're doing the work ourselves. So what we used to do is Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, it was quiet in Panama Hatties. I had Panama Hatties at the time. It was like the middle 80s. Uh-huh. We used to go out there and work on the restaurant. So we're sleeping in snorkel jackets with ski hats on. It was just miserable. It was cold all the time, right? So he sees this ad in the paper. There's this restaurant in Montauk that's doing two steaks for one, a steak night or whatever. I'm not a big steak guy, but, you know, whatever. We'll go out. So we go out there. It was kind of like a pubby place. And in the bar, they had a pool table and a dartboard and all of that. And we just wanted to be warm. There was a fireplace. So we're kind of hanging out before dinner, you know, playing darts, shooting pool. We sit down. We probably spent about 2.5 hours there. And at the end of the meal, I went to the bar to get another round of beers or whatever, and I see this bottle of Louis XIII back there. Now, you can't miss it. It's this, you know, Waterford crystal bottle with these little knobs coming off it. You know, it's very distinctive looking, right? So I see it back there, and I'm like, God, this is an odd place for Louis. Now, I'm fast-forwarding probably 15 years, right? It's now about $125 a shot. Right. So I said to the bartender, because I was so curious as to, you know, do you really sell any of that in a place like this? Because I sell Louis XIII, but it's very rare. You know, you get one or two, three, you know, every month or so, you know. Anyway, the guy says, "Yo, yeah, Louis, that's really expensive." I said, "Geez, what do you get for that?" He goes, "We get like $10 a shot." I'm like, "You get what?" He says, "It's really expensive, like $10 a shot." Now, I know I shouldn't do this. I'm in the business. I know what it costs, right? So I got the one guy on the one shoulder going, Tom, you don't do that. This is the wrong thing to do. You know, you're not going to heaven. And I got the other guy saying, if God didn't want you to drink it, he wouldn't have made it $10. You know what I mean? So I'm back and forth with this push me, pull you thing. And finally, I said, all right, give me 10. Right? So we're drinking Louis XIII for $10 a shot and drinking a bunch of it, right? I will admit. Anyway, so we leave, we go home, build a restaurant, whatever. 6-7 months later, I'm talking to this guy in one of the restaurants in Montauk. We're sitting at the bar, we're just yapping back and forth. You know, just sitting at the bar, you get the impression I drink too much, but it's really not the case, right? So I'm sitting at the bar, I'm talking to this guy who I'll call John, you know, and just met him and we're back and forth. And it turns out, he owns the place.
Uh-oh.
And I wasn't really even thinking about it at the time. And so we start talking about employees and how difficult it is and, you know, the idiotic things they do. And he goes, oh, yeah? I had a bartender giving Louis XIII away for $10 a shot. I'm like, I hope you fired him. He goes, I did. And I'm like, thank God. I mean, because if he finds out it's me, I got to move out of state. I can't even be here anymore. So anyway. It all evened out in the end, you know. And I'm not proud of, you know, doing it. It was just one of those moments in a decision and whatever. But
So tell me two things. One is, what's the difference between brandy and cognac? And is cognac a type of brandy? And then how do you drink it? I mean, is it something that's room temperature? Is it something that you put an ice cube in just to chill it a bit? Do you sip it? Do you do it as a shot?
You can do all of the above. I don't advise three or four of them, but, you know, brandy and cognac are essentially the same thing. Cognac is a region, so cognac has to be made in cognac. There's another region I personally like better called Armagnac, which is very next to cognac. And I think their style of brandy is a little more rustic and a little rougher. And I tend to like that more than the smoother for whatever reason. It's just a preference. But brandy is basically a sipper. And it's usually served, you know, by the fire in the winter because it warms you up. It's one of those things. I don't recommend drinking in the summer. It's kind of too hot for me. I kind of like most of my stuff cooler than the average bear. I mean, I like red wine a little cooler at cellar temperature. I don't like it room temperature. I don't like cognac at room temperature. I think what happens is when you serve spirits like that too warm, the alcohol takes over. You know, you get a real blast of the alcohol in the end, and I don't like the way that finishes. So, even with red wine, I think a lot of times it accentuates the alcohol in it when it's too warm. So, I personally drink cognac not that often anymore, but I like to drink it at cellar temperature around, you know, in the 50s, you know, like low to middle 50s, and you know, if you like it warmer, you can always, you know, swirl it around in your hand. That warms it up, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I remember years ago being at the Super Bowl, when the Super Bowl was at Stanford. It was the Miami Dolphins were playing the San Francisco 49ers, and I had gone to that. I used to go to Super Bowl every year for a couple of years. And somebody once said the coldest winter I ever spent was summer in San Francisco, you know, and it's true. When that fog rolled in, I was looking at my friend. I'm like, hold me. You know, it was freezing, you know, and we're in California. That's supposed to be cold. And I remember leaving there and going to Los Gatos, which is a town just south of where Stanford Stadium was. And we actually, there was a live band in it who were very good. Guitar player was a real good guitar player. And we listened to him. So I walk in and I said to the guy, do you have any cognac? And he says, yeah, we got an array of them. You know, he told me. And he did the right thing. You know, he kind of, a lot of times what they'll do is when you serve cognac, they tend to like warm the glass. And what that does is it sort of accentuates the aroma of the cognac, which is, you know, in my opinion, 30% of the experience is the nose and trying to get those sniff and the flavor. Because I think that the olfactory sense is the most privileged in the body. It kind of, you know, lets you know what's going on. You know, that's why when something stinks, you don't eat it. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So you can't see that with your eyes. Your nose tells you. Anyway, so he did the whole thing, the whole ritual with warming the glasses and the cognac was the right temperature. I remember taking a sip and just having this whole warming feeling. And I remember that as one of the maybe top five wine experiences of my life. And thinking, you know, maybe it's not the 15th glass, Tom. You know, maybe it's just that first, you know, one glass that's so good. And maybe you don't need, you know, six of these. You can only drink one of them.
I remember growing up going to a Jet game at Shea Stadium.
Oh, that was cold.
And first of all, it's just a fact. Shea Stadium was a really interesting building because for baseball, it opened up to be like a baseball field.
Yeah, sure.
But the stands actually were able to be moved towards the outfield so that it became more of a square.
Yeah, yeah, for football.
Yes, which is pretty incredible. When it was sort of like the seats were like, I mean, whole seating platform was like on casters or something.
Right, right, right.
But the reason I'm telling the story is went with my father and my buddy and his father, and we went to a game, and it was really, really cold. And well, you know, the dads did like shots of scotch or something, but it had just that reality of it going down just warmed you up.
Oh yeah, no, there's a reason that people drink cognac. I mean, and for me, it's become a by the fire in the winter. You know, just a half a glass or a glass is plenty. It's a wicked head too.
Why do I want to sing chestnuts roasting on an open fire?
Why would you do that to me? You know, I thought you liked me.
So tell me, Hennessy, is that a brandy?
I for a while there, I thought they said chefs instead of chestnuts. You know, I was, because I felt that way a couple of times in holiday season with the parties.
I'm glad we're sitting across the table from each other. Is Hennessy a brandy?
Yeah, yeah, cognac.
Gotcha. I went to this event the other night. It was a cigar dinner, and I guess people dip cigars.
I know. I don't get that whole cigar.
So they
thing,
had one that was a honey, and the other was Henny Light, they called it.
Oh, no.
But
that's all marketing stuff. I mean, you know, cognac is cognac, and I don't, you know, I'm not a cigar smoker, and you know, if not you, but if you're out there and you're a cigar smoker, you know, go at it. God bless you. It's fine. But, you know, when you, for me, if I'm tasting wine, and cognac is essentially a wine, you know, when you're tasting wine, it would seem to me that whole cigar smoke thing would kind of alter the flavor of anything you're doing.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because if you're sipping a scotch or bourbon or, you know, something like that, they're pretty potent. In the effect, but also in the sometimes in the taste. I mean, obviously, I think it's not wives' tale. I think it's true. Some of the more expensive ones just are smoother and go down smooth. But the more moderate one, maybe the cigar alters your taste, as you're saying, and allows that rougher, liquor to go down smoother. I guess.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's like matching food and wine. I'm not a cigar smoker, so I don't know. But I imagine that your mouth would feel like an ashtray at some point, you know, when you're bringing all that smoke in.
I personally don't get the smoking thing.
No.
A very, very attractive woman to me becomes not as attractive when she comes over with cigarette breath.
Yeah.
And you know, there's nothing worse than being around somebody smoking a cigar if you're not a cigar smoker. And having to deal with the
well, it gets in everything. It's in your hair, your clothes.
You come home with it, yeah.
Yeah, you smell like a house fire. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, I'm the type. I don't hang my stuff up at night. I'll put it on the back of a chair or a clothing caddy, and then hang it up the next day. But after going to an environment that's very smoky, if you're at a bar or something like that, the next morning when I go to put stuff away, I go, "Whoa!"
Yeah, you got
to
throw them out. I mean, listen, I smoked from the time I was 13 until the time I was 30, whatever, 14, whatever it was. And I remember my mother saying, "You're smoking." I'm not. I smell it on you. You can't. You know what I mean? Who knew? You know?
I don't know why my mind goes this way, but then my mind goes to people that have fire pits and stuff, and they love to have these burns. And everything is great until I wake up the next morning to go to put my pants away.
Yeah.
And there's a ray of holes from the embers.
Well, yeah, holes. And it's, you know, it gets in your clothes. I mean, you know, you have to take a shower if you're sitting outside with that stuff. It gets in my hair, you know. I have more hair than the average cat my age, I guess. But, you know, I can smell it in my hair.
Braggart.
You know? Yeah, totally. Well, it's cool to be bald now.
Yes.
Yeah, it's fashionable.
Now you're talking my language.
I know. I don't know anybody balder. Yeah, in the 70s, it would have been a problem. But now, I mean, I know guys that have hair that purposely shave their heads. You know, it's funny how fashion just, this is the lifestyle part of the show, Stu. It's funny how fashion just keeps, you know, coming around. I'm waiting for bell bottoms to come back because,
Have
they?
Oh, my God. I was out somewhere and finally dressed. Women, they are wearing bell bottoms.
That's great. I remember as a kid when they were first coming in, you know, it was tight pants were the things, the stovepipe things or whatever they called them, you know. And I was looking at bell bottoms going, baggy pants. Oh, God, I'd never wear them. 5 years later, I got 20 pair, you know. It's like
crazy. My mind goes to that show that of our youth, Laughing.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Goldie Hawn. But she would be wearing these like really tight, bare midriff type jeans,
yeah.
I guess low cut jeans.
Yeah.
And then they would taper out.
Big bell bottoms. Yeah.
And then there was elephant bell bottoms.
They were dancing in the cages there. You know, they had those cages. But you know, it's we're getting to the point where we have to go.
Get out of here.
I know. Show about nothing. Just evaporated. So we're going to close with Tom's Three Keys to Life for a second time today. Life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last. And keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And we'll see you next week.
Sweet Fancy Long Island is the award-winning dessert and pastry company that has become one of the hottest sources for bakery treats available for delivery on Long Island. Each mouth-watering creation has a personality all its own, teasing the palate with its rich flavors, complex textures, and eye-catching presentations. All items at Sweet Fancy Long Island are made 100% from scratch using the highest quality ingredients. Belgian chocolate, European butter, vanilla beans from Tahiti, and the richest, most flavorful fruits available. Their clients can enjoy any one of our delectable confections from one-of-a-kind pastries, specialty and occasion cakes, French macarons, and karma cups. Their signature line includes an assortment of charming, personalized size desserts served in miniature mason jars. The Sweet Fancy Long Island team takes great pride in presenting a unique, delicious, and elegant dessert experience and works closely with every client to create a memorable dessert that will add an exciting dimension to any celebration. Presently, the work of Sweet Fancy Long Island have been found in some of the area's top restaurants, country clubs, gourmet shops, catering facilities, and Food Network. Go to sweetfancyli.com to order online or to view their incredible gallery of desserts.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at AmanoRestaurant.com.